We'll quickly get on to our speaking event. I have the fortune of introducing to you Dr. Graham McQueen, who has spoken here before, and many of you may have seen him speak, and it's always a pleasure to hear him talk. Graham McQueen is a former member of the Religious Studies Department at McMaster University in Hamilton. His academic specialization is Buddhist Studies, in which he received his doctorate from Harvard. In 1989, Graham helped found McMaster's Center for Peace Studies, of which he became director from 1989 until 1996. He was also a founder and co-director of the Center's War and Health Program Committee and was co-director of the three-year Health of Children in War Zones project funded by Health Canada. The project was active in three war zones. Graham has been co-director of two projects in Afghanistan. He has been co-director of the Project Media and Peace Education in Afghanistan, funded by CEDA. With colleagues, he has expressed some of the principles utilized in the War and Health work of Center for Peace Studies in Peace and Change, 1997, the British Medical Journal, Medical Crossfire, and The Lancet in 2000. Graham has been active in organizations committed to peace and human rights for many years, and has at various times chaired the Hamilton Disarmament Coalition, the Board of Directors of Peace Magazine, and the National Coordinating Committee of Peace Brigades International. He is also a committed teacher and has been awarded a teaching award for his undergrad course, Theory and Practice of Nonviolence, as well as a Lifetime Achievement Award by the McMaster Student Union. Now retired, he spends his time in other research and teaching still. From a recent proposal that Graham gave regarding the People's Summit that happened in March, none of the issues the People's Summit wishes to see addressed, such as impoverishment, climate change, peak oil, or oppression of indigenous peoples, will be addressed as long as people in the West are led from one war to another by the elites who initiated and continually revive the fraudulent global war on terror. We face increasing military budgets, loss of civil rights, and large-scale killing and persecution of people abroad, especially in fossil fuel-rich areas of the world with Muslim populations. And all this takes our money, our time, our energy, when we should be concentrating on the issues of genuine importance for humanity. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Graham McQueen.
Thank you. Thank you, Paul. I want to first thank the organizers who've, honored me, really, by including me in this event, which I'll be sharing a podium with Dr. Griffin. So that would include, obviously, Paul and Josh, Adam, and I'm sure many others whose names I don't know. I want to say how glad I am to be back at Walkerton. I have only the fondest memories of speaking here before, and I love this venue. So thanks for welcoming me into your community. Here's how it's going to go. Your main speaker tonight is Dr. David Ray Griffin, sitting at the back, and I will be introducing him. However, Paul asked me to give a speech as well, and I said, fine, I will talk for half an hour, hopefully not much more than that. And I've decided to address the issue of the anthrax attacks of the fall of 2001. Now, it may seem to some of you that that's peculiar, it's a different topic than 9/11, why confuse them? But really, the whole point of my talk is that they are connected, and they're intimately connected, and we need to remember that, and we need to think about them together. Having said that, then, let me leap right in. Some people are outraged when we suggest that 9/11 was an inside job. A guy stopped me on the street the other day that I don't even know, and, you know, just wanted me to know that he thought my views on 9/11 were nutty and morally outrageous. So that happens to us quite a bit. Imagine us suggesting that Americans could kill other Americans, that they would not only kill 3,000 people in 9/11, but deliberately terrorize the whole country, their own country, that they would be be so deceptive as to not only do all that killing, but blame it on someone else, that they would frame Muslims, and that they would do so so that these people's countries could be invaded and occupied. Imagine us suggesting that. I like to remind such people that a week after the 9/11 attacks, the anthrax attacks began. And it's now known that this series of events was a deadly assault on Americans by Americans. Or if you buy the FBI's story, by one American. But I'll be explaining why I don't buy it later. The anthrax attacks not only killed Americans, they targeted U.S. senators. They deliberately spread terror throughout the whole country. They framed Muslims so that their countries could be invaded and occupied. The anthrax attacks were in many ways a classic false flag attack. So maybe, in light of that, it's not so nutty after all to suggest that 9/11 might be similar in some ways. When the anthrax attacks first occurred, we were encouraged to connect them to the 9/11 attacks. They were supposed to be the second phase in the 1-2 punch delivered by foreign terrorists to the United States. But ever since the original anthrax story, the one about the extremist Muslims, ever since that one fell apart, we've been encouraged not to connect the two stories. Now we're told how different and separate they are. Well, today I want to encourage you to remember the anthrax attacks and to connect them again, because I believe they were connected. What then were the anthrax attacks? Beginning on about September 18th, a week after 9/11, at least 7 envelopes were mailed, 5 to the media and 2 to U.S. senators, each of which contained a letter and a quantity of anthrax spores. At least 22 people became infected, some with cutaneous, that is, anthrax of the skin, anthrax, some with inhalational anthrax, which is far more deadly. 5 people died. In terms of numbers of casualties, this is obviously a minor event compared to the 9/11 attacks. But the attacks raised grave concerns. They involved a biological weapon. According to current U.S. definitions, a weapon of mass destruction. The successful use of a bioweapon had implications in some ways more serious than the hijacking of airplanes on 9/11. Note also that these attacks came at a crucial moment for the United States. The first anthrax victim, Robert Stevens, died of inhalational anthrax on October 5th, 2001. The first military strike on Afghanistan took place 2 days later. And during October, as the number of anthrax casualties mounted, and as the attack on Afghanistan escalated, the United States, the USA Patriot Act, was making its way through Congress. It was signed into law on October 26th. So the anthrax attacks contributed to the atmosphere of fear that led Americans to relinquish important civil rights and to support this first invasion of a Muslim country. I want you to remember then that September of 2001 isn't the only key month. October, in which the anthrax attacks were most active and all the propaganda connected with it was going forward, and Afghanistan was invaded, and Iraq was blamed. October 2001 is a very important month in U.S. history. But who did it? Who was responsible for the anthrax attacks? If we look at the first anthrax letter to be recovered, we see that the letter presents itself as the work of extremist Muslims connected with the attacks of 9/11. You read that? The date is at the top, 9/11/01. And the next letter, by the way, that came about, that was sent several weeks after this, had exactly the same date, written exactly the same at the top. These people want to connect this to 9/11. This is next, they said. Take penicillin now. Death to America, death to Israel. Allah is great. There's a strange contradiction within these anthrax envelopes. We find the most sophisticated weaponized anthrax spores ever seen. I'm talking about the anthrax sent to the two senators here a little later than this one. Most sophisticated weaponized anthrax ever seen. And yet the perpetrators cannot spell penicillin, as some of you will have noticed. What's going on? It took me a little bit of thought to decide that probably what's going on is that we were supposed to believe from the outset that there was a double perpetrator. I think we were supposed to believe that, in quotation marks, Al-Qaeda prepared and sent the letters, and that this rather primitive group couldn't manage the English language properly and made misspellings and unidiomatic English expressions and so on. But the anthrax itself was way beyond Al-Qaeda's capabilities and pointed to a state supplier, Iraq. I think the idea had always been to frame both Al-Qaeda and Iraq. And by the way, Al-Qaeda, what does that mean? You should put it in quotation marks every time I use it, because it doesn't mean what we normally think it does. In fact, I think the idea had been to frame them both, not only for the anthrax attacks, but for 9/11 as well. That was the original idea. Al-Qaeda provided the visible hitman. Al-Qaeda strikes the United States. But Iraq stood behind in the shadows. Remember, connecting Iraq to 9/11 took a bit of work. Remember, they tried very, very hard. It took a bit of work. But blaming the anthrax attacks on Iraq was supposed to be easy. That was their assumption. Iraq's anthrax program had been known about for years and had received a lot of press in the United States ever since the 1991 Gulf War. The UN Special Commission had destroyed Iraq's anthrax in the 1990s, but propagandists in the U.S. convinced many Americans that the wily Saddam had outsmarted the UN and kept his arsenals intact. So for many people in the United States, 2001, anthrax still equaled Iraq and still equaled an ever-present threat. So let's look, I'll just get rid of this for a moment. Let's look at how Iraq and Al-Qaeda were blamed as dual perpetrators in October of 2001. On October 14th, the UK newspaper The Guardian reported that, now I quote, American investigators probing anthrax outbreaks in Florida and New York believe they have all the hallmarks of a terrorist attack and have named Iraq as prime suspect as the source of the deadly spores. Their inquiries are adding to what U.S. hawks say is a growing mass of evidence that Saddam Hussein was involved with the September 11th hijackers. That may be a surprising conclusion for you. What The Guardian is doing is saying people are actually linking four things: Iraq, anthrax, September 11th hijackers, that is Al-Qaeda, and 9/11, but they're all connected. And The Guardian goes on to say that pressure is building for a military attack on Iraq. Iraq. This is just a month after the 9/11 attacks. Afghanistan is currently being attacked. Iraq is next. The following day, October 15th, the Wall Street Journal says, and it's talking about the anthrax mailings here, several circumstantial links to Osama bin Laden and his Al-Qaeda network are already known. But bin Laden couldn't be doing all this in Afghan caves. The leading supplier suspect has to be Iraq. So in other words, the Wall Street Journal is laying it out for us very, very clearly. Late October, ABC News says several times that multiple independent sources, one point they say three, then they say four, have assured ABC that researchers have discovered bentonite among the anthrax spores. Since bentonite was used by Iraq to help weaponize its anthrax, and to weaponize just means to turn it into a weapon, to make it more deadly, since bentonite is Iraqi as a method, the spores therefore bore Saddam's signature. Now, this intensive attempt in October 2001 to pull Iraq into it, to blame Iraq, failed to convince the scientific community, I'll say a few words about that in a moment. Blaming Iraq, however, continued. It simply had no scientific basis after this point, and it had to function through innuendo, half-truths, in other words, as propaganda. Let me give you an important example. In 2003, you will remember, Colin Powell appeared before the UN Security Council to make the case for the invasion of Iraq. And he held up a vial of simulated anthrax. You remember this picture. Here's what he said as he held it up. Less than a teaspoon of dry anthrax, a little bit, about this amount, shut down the United States Senate in the fall of 2001. This forced several hundred people to undergo emergency medical treatment and killed two postal workers just from an amount, just about this quantity that was inside an envelope. You notice he doesn't actually say Iraq did it. That's because it was widely known by that point that Iraq had nothing to do with it. But he was determined to keep the connection alive in his viewers' mind by mentioning them together. And that's how propaganda works. The attempt to frame Al-Qaeda, in quotes, and Iraq ran into trouble because the perpetrators weren't able to keep complete control over the scientific community. In the case of 9/11, the perpetrators have, until recently, had a really surprising amount of success, at least it surprised me, in controlling the scientific community. Think of their control of FEMA, Federal Emergency Management Agency, and NIST, National Institute of Standards and Technology, as well as many scientists in universities, public, private sector, who should be speaking out about the obvious absurdities of 9/11. Really, I've been surprised and impressed by the amount of control of the science that these folks have been able to achieve. By comparison, they failed badly in the anthrax case. Tom Ridge of the newly formed Department of Homeland Security announced as early as November of 2001 that there was no bentonite in the anthrax. And in January of 2002, he said that it appeared the anthrax came from a domestic source, came from the United States. Later in 2002, the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology. So what's interesting here is that even within the military and security network, there's no consensus. The Armed Forces Institute of Pathology, which had been asked to analyze the anthrax sent to Senator Daschle, supported Tom Ridge and said the additive they found among the spores was not the substance used by Iraq. In fact, the anthrax used in the attacks was a particular strain of anthrax called the Ames strain, originally discovered in the wild in Texas, 1981, and used after that mainly in labs in the United States and its allies. There was not a scrap of evidence, and there still isn't, that Al-Qaeda or Iraq had ever gotten hold of the Ames strain. Iraq used different strains. When it was further discovered that the methods used to weaponize the anthrax spores, including coating them with silicon dioxide, were actually closer to U.S. methods than Iraqi methods, it started to become clear that this was an inside job. And that was basically what Tom Ridge was announcing already in January 2002. The jig was up. Muslims had been framed, and by 2002, this started to become clear to just about everyone. But if Al-Qaeda and Iraq didn't commit the crime, who did? Let's consider the four broad possibilities. And I find this quadrant, this series of four quadrants, sometimes helpful. So initially we were supposed to believe the perpetrators were quadrant three. I suppose I should pause for a moment. So we have the possibilities. Number one, foreign individual, then domestic individual, in this case meaning in the United States, foreign group, domestic group, okay? So initially we were supposed to believe the perpetrators were quadrant three, Al-Qaeda and Iraq. But when scientists undercut that hypothesis, the FBI was in a dilemma. They had to abandon quadrant three. Nobody was pushing for quadrant one, foreign individual, and quadrant four had to be avoided at all costs, domestic group. It therefore did what is often done in these situations, went to quadrant two. The crime, they said, was committed by a lone domestic perpetrator, not only that, but by a lone nut. The lone nut hypothesis is obviously very popular. If the person is in some ways insane or unbalanced, their story is, as Shakespeare would say, a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. It means nothing. Who cares? There will always be nuts, the idea. So you don't have to probe institutions. You don't have to look at your society and your political structures. The lone nut, in other words, is a hypothesis very useful for marginalizing, taming, domesticating, keeping a story under control. After years of confusion, the FBI settled in 2008 on Dr. Bruce Ivins as its lone nut of choice. Dr. Ivins was a research scientist who spent years working on a vaccine for anthrax. He had, by the way, cooperated with the FBI, helped them in their investigation. Early on in the investigation, they gave him a polygraph test, which he passed. His office was at the United States Army Military Research Institute of Infectious Diseases in Fort Detrick, Maryland. Dr. Ivins conveniently died a week before he was publicly named by the FBI as the perpetrator, the anthrax criminal. So he will never have the chance to defend himself in a court of law. He allegedly committed suicide by taking an overdose of Tylenol. Well, I think he had bipolar disorder. He was in terrible anxiety and depression, and he may very well have taken his life. On the other hand, he left no note, there was no autopsy performed, and frankly, I'm not willing to give the FBI the benefit of the doubt. So he died, and that's all we know. The case against Dr. Ivins is set out in a recent 92-page document from the U.S. Department of Justice, which you can find on the internet and read. The case is circumstantial at its best, ludicrous at its worst. Personally, I do not think Ivins had any part in the anthrax mailings. I think it's clear he was framed. But I can't prove that, and fortunately, I don't have to, especially today. I'm more concerned to argue that no single individual could have carried out these attacks. They were the work of a group. This was quadrant four, the famous suppressed option that people don't like to talk about. Of course they don't like to talk about. What does it mean if you've got a group of people cooperating and stuck in the heart of the U.S. security and military apparatus? Well, what is the evidence that suggests that it's quadrant four? There are actually several forms of evidence, and some of them are even kind of up my alley. I mean, you know, I do textual analysis, literary analysis, and some of the evidence is of that kind, but it's complex. And I don't have time to get into it today, so I'll stick to the most obvious kind of evidence, which is the scientific evidence relating to the anthrax spores. Basic argument is simple. The anthrax was too sophisticated to have been prepared by any single person and could have come only from a group in the United States involved in the highest level of work on the weaponization of anthrax. The anthrax spores were cultured and dried, cleaned of all dead cells and refuse. They were very fine and of uniform size, about 1.5 to 3 micrometers in diameter, perfect for entering the human lungs and staying there. And by the way, there had been research in the United States years before that suggested if you wanted to culture and prepare anthrax in a way that would kill people most effectively, you had to have anthrax spores of that size. Small enough to pass through the nose hairs and so on into the lungs, but not so small they would be breathed out again. Want to get in there and they want to lodge there, and that's exactly what size they are. This anthrax was so fine, and I'm talking about the anthrax sent to the senators here, it passed through the pores of the paper in the envelopes, which is why two postal workers died. There were 1 trillion spores per gram, about 2 grams per letter. This is the highest concentration ever achieved. And the spores have been treated in several ways to reduce their natural tendency to stick together and form clumps. They were apparently given a weak electrostatic charge, and since they all received the same charge, they tended to repel one another and to disperse readily in the air. The spores were coated with silica, silicon dioxide, and according to some researchers, with a polymerized glass as well. All of this is to make them fine, not stick together, and easily take to the air and be easily breathed in. to make them an aerosol, essentially. These spores took to the air so readily that when the letter to Senator Daschle was opened, a good deal of the anthrax powder immediately lifted off and disappeared, contaminating the entire very large building. When scientists wanted to weigh the anthrax they recovered from the letters to the senators, they had difficulty getting it to settle in the vial. When they tried to get it to cling to tape, it bounced off. This was sophisticated stuff, and to produce it required many different skills. Bruce Ivins, the so-called anthrax killer, according to his colleagues, certainly did not have all these skills. Nor did any individual. As one researcher commented, this was a multidisciplinary effort. The two institutions most likely to have produced the anthrax used in the attacks are Battelle Memorial Institute and Dugway Proving Ground, both of which are connected to the U.S. military and intelligence community. Now, the FBI and a group of scientists supportive of it would dispute some of what I've just said about the anthrax. The FBI currently claims that the anthrax wasn't especially sophisticated, that it wasn't coated with silica or anything else, and that Bruce Ivins was able to prepare it during a series of late evenings at the lab. They say it was very fishy. He stayed late at the lab for several evenings. When I mentioned this to friends who work in the lab in biology and so on, they laugh uproariously the number of times they've stayed late at the lab. The FBI even disputes the description of the anthrax as weaponized. Now, I don't have time today to get into the details of this dispute, but it's important for you to know that it isn't just dissidents or non-scientists who disagree with the FBI. We're talking about leading anthrax specialists, such as Richard Spurtzel and Merle Nass, several U.S. senators, researchers at the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology, which I mentioned. This is the newsletter in which they describe the anthrax, which they analyzed directly themselves in their lab. They say, yes, it's aerosolized. It's coated with silica. Look at the X-ray and so on. The U.S. Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases, this is where Ivins worked, and 16 scientists writing for the Journal of the American Medical Association in 2002. These are just examples of people whose analysis is completely contrary to what the FBI claims. On April 22nd, that is, of this year, just about a week ago, a microbiologist who supervised Ivins, that is the so-called anthrax killer, at Fort Detrick, appeared before a panel of the National Academy of Sciences. Dr. Henry Hein reminded the panel that according to the FBI, Ivins needed only about 34 hours in his lab to prepare the anthrax for the attacks. Hein said the FBI's estimate was, quote, more than 8,000 hours short of what he would have needed. Run that by you again. The FBI's estimate was more than 8,000 hours short of what he would have needed. I think if you take the time to research these attacks, as I've done, most of you will agree with me that the FBI is promoting what it knows perfectly well is junk science, just as it does with regard to 9/11. To sum up the story so far, story A, given to us, extremist Muslims, was false, and is now acknowledged to be false. Story B, the lone nut, is also false, though the FBI continues to stick to it. My view, and this view is supported by many other people, is that the attack came from a group in the heart of the military and intelligence community in the United States. But there's more. There's more. We were told initially, when the attacks first occurred, that there were connections between the anthrax attacks and the so-called hijackers of 9/11 fame. And hijackers is in quotation marks here. There's so many things that have to be in quotation marks. Al-Qaeda hijackers, Muhammad Atta, you can put everything in quotation marks. But anyway, the so-called hijackers. We heard a lot when the anthrax attacks first began about these connections, but we don't hear much about them now. I wonder why. Perhaps it's because if there really were connections between the anthrax perpetrators and the 9/11 hijackers, And if the anthrax perpetrators were from the U.S. military intelligence community, this might tell us something we're not supposed to know about the 19 hijackers. This might tell us something we're not supposed to know about the 19 hijackers. To spell it out, they were obviously connected to the military and intelligence community in the United States as well. Let's look at a couple of examples of these connections that were much talked about at one time. Begin with the Florida connection. At least 14 of the 19 hijackers had a connection to Florida. And that, from the St. Petersburg Times, shows the locations where the hijackers were known to be active. They're the little black squares. And you can see that the main area of concentration is along the southeast coast of Florida, between West Palm Beach and Miami. And where did the first anthrax case appear? Remember Robert Stevens, who died on October 5th? He contracted anthrax right there in Boca Raton, in the middle of this region. Is this a coincidence? Well, of course it could be. We've all experienced coincidences in our life, but let's pursue the connection further. Stevens worked as a photo editor for a tabloid in Boca Raton called The Sun. The Sun was owned by the same people that owned the National Enquirer. Yeah? So that's what I mean by tabloid. My little graph shows The Sun as a sun. Robert Stevens is photo editor. The editor-in-chief is Mike Irish, whose wife, Gloria, knew two of the hijackers, Hamza Al-Kamdi and Marwan Al-Shehi. She didn't just know them. She was a real estate agent. She's the one who found the both apartments in Boca Raton. And Marwan Al-Shehi's apartment was co-signed as guarantor by the famous Muhammad Atta, the leader of the so-called hijackers. Is this still a coincidence? Well, the Irishes claim it is. Of course it could be, but I don't think so. I don't think so. And part of the reason I don't think so is because there are too many coincidences. I know of five incidents that appear to connect the 19 hijackers to the anthrax attacks. The death of Robert Stevens is just one. Some of the others involve crop duster planes. Now, what does a crop duster plane signify? What is it supposed to mean here? In theory, a crop duster plane could be used to spread a number of biological or chemical agents. But in the incidents in question here, I think it is supposed to signify to us anthrax and Iraq. Iraq was known to have a couple of different methods of dispersing its anthrax, and this was known in the 90s, and one of them was through by spraying from planes. Earlier, I referred to Colin Powell's appearance before the Security Council in 2003. Let's look at Powell again. Here's an image he showed to the Security Council. You may not be able to make out the picture, but look at the caption at the top. Iraqi test flight spraying simulated anthrax. Here's what Powell is saying as he shows this. The Iraqi regime has also developed ways to disperse lethal biological agents. Note the spray coming from beneath the Mirage. Mirage jet fighter. That's 2,000 liters of simulated anthrax, end of quote. The connection U.S. planners wanted to embed in the minds of their citizens was this. Spraying substances from a plane in this connection equals anthrax and equals Iraq. So if we find the 19 hijackers toying with crop dusters, we're supposed to conclude they're supported by Iraq. Actually, there's no point trying to have a crop duster unless you have a massive amount of the agent you're going to spray. And a few grams of anthrax is no good. You have to have many, many liters, either dry or liquid anthrax. So the supplier is Iraq, and Al-Qaeda is going to then take it and spray it over the U.S. population. On September 16, 2001, 5 days after 9/11, all crop dusters in the U.S. were ordered to stay on the ground. It had been discovered that Zacharias Moussaoui, the so-called 20th hijacker, had been looking into crop duster planes. On October 11th, George Bush referred in a press conference to Al-Qaeda getting hold of crop dusters to spray biological or chemical weapons on the American people. Now, I'm getting close to the end of this talk, but I want to give you one more story. I want to describe to you one of the alleged crop duster incidents so that you'll get a feeling for this connection. This is a story about Muhammad Atta, the famously scary leader of the hijackers. And I was talking to David Ray Griffin a few minutes ago, and he said we should call this guy the American Muhammad Atta, because there appeared to have been more than one of this gentleman. I will just refer to him as Muhammad Atta here. Remember that this is the man who was supposedly the leader of the group charged with the most deadly secret mission, emphasis on secret, ever put into practice on U.S. soil. If the group's plans were discovered in advance, the whole 9/11 operation would have come to nothing. Secrecy was essential. I wish somebody would write a book called The Top Secret Exploits of Muhammad Atta. There would be a chapter called Muhammad Atta Rents a Car. Another, Muhammad Atta Draws Up a Will. Muhammad Atta Visits the Pink Pony Strip Club in Florida. And so on. If you read these stories, you'll find he behaves in a very peculiar way for a top secret terrorist. He seems to inevitably get himself remembered and noticed. The story I'm going to tell you now could be called Muhammad Atta Asks for a Loan. First mention of this story by the media appears to have been on September 25th, 2001, which is an interesting date, after 9/11, but before anybody is discovered to have anthrax. The detailed version I give here is based on an interview with Jonelle Bryant by ABC News in 2002. So here's the story, according to Jonelle Bryant. It's spring of the year 2000. Man enters the office of Jonelle Bryant, a loan officer in Florida for the U.S. Department of Agriculture. The man says he's from Afghanistan. Actually, Atta, the real Atta at least, is from Egypt, and it would have made him less sound much less fishy if he'd said Egypt. He says Afghanistan. He makes sure Bryant gets his name right. That's A-T-T-A, says the top secret terrorist. He's new to the United States, he says, and he has a dream. He wants to dust American crop. To this end, he seeks a loan of $650,000 with which to buy a 6-passenger aircraft. He wants to convert the plane from its present use to a crop duster by removing every square inch of seating except the pilot seat and installing a large chemical tank. When Bryant explains that he can't simply walk out the door with $650,000 in cash, he will have to go through an application process. He becomes agitated and belligerent. He asks what's to prevent him from going around the desk, cutting her throat, and taking the cash. I would have thought this is the moment when you phone security. Bryant, however, is unfazed and warns him, she knows karate. She goes on to explain that he's ineligible for the loan anyway because he isn't a U.S. citizen. At this point, Atta notices a picture on her wall. It's an aerial photograph of Washington, D.C. He admires its, and now I'm quoting from the interview, its panoramic view that captured all the monuments and buildings in one photograph. And he points specifically at the Pentagon and the White House. He becomes obsessed with this photograph, saying it's the best he's ever seen. He starts throwing cash on Bryant's desk. When she refuses to part with her aerial photograph, and of course I'm making reference to the obvious fact that these guys attacked the Pentagon, right, from the air. When she refuses to part with her aerial photograph, he grows bitter, and asks her how America would like it if some country were to come and destroy these Washington monuments. We aren't told her reply, but they continue to chat in a friendly manner. Atta mentions that he would like to visit the World Trade Center in New York. And he asks Bryant what the security is like in the buildings. Somehow he inserts into this conversation the information that in his country there's a group called Al-Qaeda and a wonderful leader named Osama bin Laden. Someday, he tells her, bin Laden will be famous. When he leaves, Bryant shakes his hand and wishes him good luck. It's only in retrospect, looking back in 2002, that she sees her mistake and blames herself for not recognizing how evil he was. After all, she says, he had very scary looking eyes. And that, my friends, is the story of how top-secret terrorist Muhammad Atta asked for a loan. What are we supposed to make of this nonsense? It seems to me that there are two possibilities. The first is that the story is fiction. Somebody made it up. Never happened. In this case, we need to ask, who made up the story and why did they make it up? Who wanted to connect Al-Qaeda to crop duster funds? The second possibility is not really all that different. In this case, the events really happened, but Atta is obviously not a top-secret terrorist. He's an operative tasked with making himself visible and unforgettable. He's laying down a trail from the 9/11 hijackers to crop duster planes. Someone wants us to think that Iraq, the anthrax attacks, Al-Qaeda, and 9/11 are connected. Well, I think they were connected. But the perpetrators were not extremist Muslims from across the seas. They were much closer to home, and they are still at large. Thank you.